From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Today we go to Nicaragua to speak with journalist Stephen Sefton. Stephen has been observing the elections that are going on now this month in the whole region of Latin America and the Caribbean, participated in the elections that took part in Nicaragua on the 7th. We're going to get some results of that and also the election that took place this past weekend in Argentina. And then we'll be looking forward and discussing this coming weekend's elections in Venezuela and Chile and the following week's election in Honduras, which should be a real doozy. A lot of moving parts. So, Stephen, let's start with Nicaragua. And first of all, welcome and thanks for coming back to talk with us.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me, Don.
So,
Nicaragua held its national elections on Sunday, November the 7th. They held them on a Sunday to allow as many people as possible to vote with as much facility as possible. I was accompanying a group of reporters from the United States that included people like Daniel Kovalik, Caleb Maupin, there are some people from the show called The Convo Couch, Fiorella and Craig, and various other people, Camila Escalante from Corsachin News, and altogether a very talented group of journalists who arrived in Nicaragua to cover the elections. Perhaps we can talk about why they thought it was so important later. But anyway, the nitty-gritty was that we traveled as a group on Saturday afternoon to the town, the northwestern town of Chinandega, which is the departmental capital of the department of Chinandega. And that's a very important agricultural area in Nicaragua, and it also has the country's biggest maritime port, Corinto. Mm. Which is its gateway to the world, really, in terms of trade, pending the construction that's underway of a deep water port on the Atlantic coast, the Caribbean coast. So in Chinandega, on the morning of the of election day, we visited a total of 4 voting centres, and most of the voting centres are schools because they have sufficient infrastructure space to cope with a large number of people arriving to take part in the vote. Each voting centre usually had anything between 4 to 12 actual polling stations, and each polling station served anything between 200 and 400 voters. Okay. And so when people arrived, they checked that they were on the voting roll for that centre. If they weren't on that voting roll, if they were able to go on a motorbike, they were taken on a motorbike to the voting centre that they should have gone to. And if they weren't able to jump on a motorbike, they were taken in some other vehicle, like a pickup or an ordinary car. So it was very well organized. Each center had a set of 4 or 5 assistants operating computers so that if there were any doubts about the details of the individuals, their voting identification, they could sort that out through the national database. And also there were a number of assistants to help people with disability or to help people who were elderly to reach because their polling station, because sometimes the polling stations were upstairs. Anyway, we visited those 4 voting stations in the course of the morning of Sunday the 7th. Uh-huh. There was a steady flow of voters. I personally didn't see any queues anywhere. But in other parts, in particular in Managua, apparently there were some queues, although the queue to vote moved very quickly because the system was so well organized and efficient. And we spoke to people. We spoke to somebody who said that an opposition person who said that they actually didn't have confidence in the vote, but they said that quite openly to us. They didn't kind of try and hide what they were saying. So, you know, the idea that there's some kind of dictatorship here is absolutely ridiculous.
Right.
And that was the only person that we spoke to that said that they didn't really have faith in the election process. We asked dozens of people in the course of the morning what they thought about the election process, and they all said that they had confidence in it. They were very happy with the actual voting process itself. They had confidence in the count, you know. So, from the point of view of our group of reporters on the spot, we found that the election process had great acceptance among the overwhelming majority of the population. And then in the evening, we returned to Managua and we waited for the result until about 2:30 in the morning. That was when they gave the first results. And the first results were overwhelmingly in favor of the Frente Sandinista coalition. There were a total in the areas on that were not the Caribbean coast voting areas. There are two regions in Nicaragua that have a separate administrative and electoral structure. On the Caribbean coast, there were seven parties participating, six of which were opposition parties, and the Sandinista Alliance representing the ruling Sandinista party in the government. In the rest of the country, on the Pacific coast, there were only six parties taking place, five opposition parties and the Sandinista Alliance. And it's ridiculous to say, and I've read some of the coverage, the astonishing coverage that has appeared in North America and Europe, claiming that there were no opposition parties, claiming that presidential candidates had been locked up, there was massive abstention, and all of it is like bizarro world. And I don't know what country they're reporting on. They're certainly not reporting on the Nicaragua that our group witnessed and visited all day Sunday. And the results were overwhelmingly in favor of the Frente Sandinista, as all the serious polls had suggested. The turnout was just under 66%,
right,
which is in the middle range for Nicaragua. Nicaragua's electoral participation ranges from anything around 58% up to over 70%. So this 65% participation was in the middle of the range,
which is a record for the U.S. by the way. In the 2020 election, when you had record turnout in the U.S., it was about 64% turnout.
Right.
Just for reference.
Yeah,
in other words, a larger percentage turned out for this election than turned out for the U.S. presidential election, which was a record last year.
Right. Well, no, this is pretty average for Nicaragua. A high turnout would have been over 70%.
Right.
So then in terms of the actual number of voters, there were 4.3 million voters eligible to vote. Of those, just under 2,800,000 actually turned out to vote, giving the 65% participation figure. And of those 65%, an average of 75% across the country voted for President Ortega as the president, Rosario Murillo as the vice president, and they voted for well over 60 deputies in the in Nicaragua's legislature. So it was a very good result for the Frente Sandinista, somewhat similar to the result in 2016, perhaps a little better. Mm-hmm. If you try and analyze that, well, what percentage of the actual electorate does the Sandinista vote represent? It actually represents 49% of the total electorate.
Oh, all of it, right. That's right.
Which is an extremely high figure.
Yeah, that's right. Can say, you know, within margin of error of 1 or 2%, a majority of the entire population supports the government.
Yeah.
That's reasonable.
So, and that in many ways, and it was in some ways, it was quite a boring result. because it didn't. It's practically no change in the electoral loyalties that the elections represented, and in Nicaragua, as elsewhere in other countries like Venezuela, for example, you have around 40 to 45% of people that support the Frente Sandinista. You have about 25 to 30% that support the right wing opposition, and everybody else is an independent or a don't know.
Right, in the middle,
when you come to election time,
right,
that translates into usually about 60 to 65. In this case, it was over 70% support for the Frente Sandinista.
Right.
And so it's a very good result.
And that's the area where you end up doing horse trading in politics, too, by the way. You've got this little swing vote in the middle, and people try to play to it. And what's weird is the way that the right usually works, you know, the left are supposed to be the hardcore ideologues, impractical, you know, practically like the Catholic Church in the 14th century or something. But it's actually, in these countries, the right wing that's the hardcore ideologues that they'll boycott elections instead of making a play for that, you know, 15% or whatever, that if they swing it, they can take power with it. But it seems like they just want to wreck the institutions rather than, you know, they want to light the board game, the game board on fire instead of trying to win it.
Yeah, one of the different things about this election was that there was no U.S. government money funding the opposition.
Mm. So you had an election.
Because of measures that the government took last year.
Right.
The U.S. government could not intervene in these elections as it has done in the past. Right. And also, there was, because the local big business is so divided, there was no significant funding from the big business organizations here in Nicaragua.
Right, some of them actually made the money, right?
So that meant that the opposition, who, just like in Venezuela, they're as divided among themselves as they are against the ruling Sandinista party in this case.
Right.
So, you know, and in that sense, it was an election, and also the authorities here refused to allow so-called observers from the Organization of American States or from the European Union.
Yeah.
So there was no internal interference in that sense. But in terms of the electoral observation, there was something like 600 local observers from the national universities. There were also a total of between reporters and people who'd been invited by the Nicaraguan government to accompany the elections. And they used that term. They used the term accompany rather than observe, because they wanted to overcome that neo-colonial syndrome,
right,
of, you know, that in some sense. Countries in Latin America have to have people from North America or Europe looking over their shoulders, right, to make sure they get things right.
That's right. We're going to look over your shoulder, you know, mate, so you do it right.
Those days are gone.
Good.
And certainly here in Nicaragua. And so accompanying the national observers, there was a team of, I think it was in total, there were actually 67 reporters. That's a figure that I saw. And also a total of about 140 other people that accompanied the elections. And, you know, I know people like Jerry Condon from Veterans for Peace. There was a group from Black Alliance for Peace. And so what you had here in Nicaragua was a recognition of the legitimacy of holding anti-imperialist views,
right?
You know, and it was those people who were invited to accompany the elections, and these people aren't stooges. You know, the people from Black Alliance for Peace and the people from Veterans for Peace and other similar organizations, Task Force for the Americas,
right,
they're very serious people. And if they'd seen irregularities, they'd have noted them and reported them.
Of course.
And they didn't.
Right.
So and they were very careful about asking when they visited the polling stations. They asked in the polling stations who represented the opposition party, so that they could be sure that, because what happens in Nicaragua is that in each polling station there's a representative of each of the political parties that are on the ballot, and it's there in the polling station that the opposition fiscales, they call them, oversight officers, monitor the count, make sure that their party's vote is protected, and at the end of the day, when all the voting is over, they fill out a tally sheet with the number of votes for each party, and each of the oversight officers for each of the political parties has to sign off on that tally sheet. And that tally sheet is what gets sent to the municipal counting center, subsequently to the departmental counting center, and finally to the national counting center in Managua. And at every stage, there are opposition party oversight officers monitoring the respective count at every level. And they have copies of the tally sheets from every polling station. So it's impossible for there to be fraud of any significance.
Yeah, it can be audited by almost everyone involved in the food chain, basically.
Right, yeah. A total of 245,000 people from all the different political parties staffed the polling stations across the country. There were 13,000 polling stations across the country in a total of something like 3,200 voting centers. Yeah. And so it was a very complex organization, and it was very, very efficiently organized. And so, you know, and what you see reported in North American news outlets or in European news outlets claiming that there was massive fraud is just ridiculous. They haven't a clue what they're talking about. None of the major news outlets sent reporters to cover the elections.
None of them seem concerned about the fact here, by the way, that rather than having machines that where, you know, the ballots come out of them and people hand count them or can see, you know, the printouts and audit those to make sure that the way the votes were input by the voters is the way that they were registered by the machines and or the people. Here we have black boxes. People push in buttons on the way, you know, when they arrive. It spits out some paper or some electrons that say what the totals are on the way out. You say, I'd like to audit it, and they push the buttons again, and it's the same number comes out. You say, well, can you show us how that operates and how they calculate it? No, it's proprietary.
Yeah. No, and the other thing that's a protection in Nicaragua is that all the oversight officers at each polling station sign that they received the number of ballot papers that correspond to their polling station.
Right.
So you can't suddenly grab hold of a bunch of ballot papers from somewhere else and stuff them in the ballot box.
People see how many people came in. They see how many they pull out of the machine at the end of the day. They say, I was there all day. I counted 311. What do you got? 313. There's two something. We got to look at that. But everybody can see almost every aspect of it. It's all visible. And here you have no idea. Yeah. We know how many people they say show up, and we know how many people they say voted, but we don't know how any of those votes were recorded, and we don't know what the medium was that they were recorded on, and we're not even allowed to look, even in court. It's proprietary.
Right. Yeah, my friend John Perry is producing a piece for the Council on Hemispheric Affairs that should appear over the next couple of days, analyzing the phony claims of fraud and demonstrating how ridiculous they are. So keep an eye out for that.
I will, definitely.
On the website of the Council for Hemispheric Affairs.
And I'll link
so to perhaps
that.
We should move on to the vote in Argentina.
Go ahead. That was this past Sunday or this past weekend, yes.
Yeah, this past weekend. So in Argentina voted, they had legislative elections. And I didn't follow them that closely, but I was actually surprised that the ruling Frente de Todos coalition did as well as they did, because the primary results earlier in the year suggested that they might suffer a very serious setback,
right,
and the right wing might even take power in terms of controlling the legislature.
Right.
Well, that didn't happen, thank goodness.
No.
By some miracle, the the Frente de Todos managed to pull themselves together, and they didn't do well in terms of making gains, but at least they were able, they remained the biggest party in the lower house, and they lost their majority in the upper house, the Senate.
Right.
But so it's going to be more difficult for them to get their government legislation through the legislature, but at least they didn't suffer a wipeout. And that suggests a couple of things. It suggests that the economic mitigation measures that Alberto Fernandez's government has implemented are beginning to have some impact on the daily lives of people. It also suggests that the majority of people in the country, although they may not be entirely happy with the measures of Alberto Fernandez's government, right, feel even less happy about right. the prospect of a return to power of the extreme right wing that destroyed the country under Mauricio Macri.
Right.
There's really not much to say about Argentina, really, because what's happened is very simple. The Frente para Todos, the Front for Everybody, which is the ruling coalition, held the line. They didn't suffer a crushing defeat, and it looks as though that may mean that gives them a base to build on to do better in the next presidential elections. Well, we'll see.
Yeah, we'll see.
But at least they've got some breathing room now. They didn't suffer a crushing defeat, and that it looks as though they may be able to rebuild their support as long as they do better. And you may remember that what was it? A couple of months ago, 3 months ago, something like that. We were talking about a situation in which Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, who's the vice president to Alberto Fernandez, kind of shook things up, this was after the primaries, and she said, "Look, if we don't sort ourselves out and demonstrate that we really are focused on the needs of ordinary people, we're going to get wiped out in the legislative elections." That's what she was saying, essentially.
Yep.
Alberto Fernandez didn't like it. He didn't like having his authority challenged in that way.
Being read.
But he was mature enough to take it as an attempt to engage in constructive debate about, you know, are our policies working or are they not? And if they're not, well, what are we going to do?
Right.
And so on. That seems to have been the point at which the Frente para Todos in Argentina got their act together and managed to prevent a wipeout in these legislative elections. So good for them.
And then going forward, looking at 2023, and Macri apparently is positioning himself for that too, by the way. You know, perhaps this time they can, you know, rather than tacking to the right, maybe tack back to the left so they can start building first some enthusiasm among their base. And then, you know, some of the people that have been sitting on their hands since the previous presidential election when Macri got elected, and, you know, to encourage those people to come back into the process and put a leftist government back in power.
Right. Well, we'll see, won't we? I think the essential conflict inside the Frente de Todos, the ruling coalition led by Alberto Fernandez, is that between the more radical positions that are adopted by Cristina Fernandez and the need to accommodate kind of centre-right social democrats like Sergio Massa.
Right.
And that's the essential tension that they're having to deal with. Who knows how will they manage it successfully in the run up to 2023? Who knows? We'll see.
And we'll see. And the folks here characterize it as basically a coalition of Peronists and Kirchnerists, and that being, I guess, the two points of tension: one tacking more towards the center right, and the other more towards the left.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. So, okay, so let's move to Venezuela and Chile coming up.
And Chile, yeah. So next Sunday is going to be a very big day for Latin America, because although the election in Nicaragua was very significant because it's kind of such an outright challenge to U.S. domination in Central America. The election in Argentina was not quite so dramatic in regional terms, in terms of its significance, but it's still pretty significant that a more or less progressive ruling coalition managed to hold their ground in an adverse context. So then on the 21st, what you're looking at is something that's a bit more dramatic in regional terms, because you have the elections in Venezuela for the 23 governorships, and also the elections for, I think it's a total of 335 municipalities, the mayoral elections across the country.
Right.
And you'd expect after the incredible hardship that people in Venezuela have suffered as a result of US and European sanctions, also Canadian sanctions as well, of course, that the ruling United Socialist Party of Venezuela would be at a substantial disadvantage, but they're not.
Right.
That's not the case. It looks as though they're going to do very well in those elections. They may lose some ground, but they'll probably win an overall majority easily in the 23 governorships and in the 335 municipalities. And that in itself would be a tremendous victory for progressive and radical forces in Latin America and the Caribbean.
Right.
The fact that a country against which the United States has inflicted the most extreme economic hardship, the most extreme diplomatic efforts at diplomatic isolation, the most extreme measures affecting its trade and its ability to carry out financial transactions, its ability to run its oil industry, which is such an important component of Venezuela's economy. And essentially, the United States policies have failed.
Right.
And they have inflicted serious hardship on Venezuela's people, but politically, they've been a complete failure. And the United Socialist Party of Venezuela are going to do exceptionally well in those elections, despite everything that the United States has done to make that not happen.
Oh, for sure. We've got about a minute and a half left, so maybe take a quick look at Chile.
Okay, in Chile, let's talk about Chile. And also in Chile, you have a situation after a very volatile 2-3 years in Chile, you have a situation now where there's likely to be a second round runoff. The two candidates that are likely to come out first and second in the first round of voting are a kind of Gabriel Boric and a guy called, I think it's Jose Antonio Kast, an extreme right winger. Those two are likely to come out first and second in the first round. I don't know in which order, we'll see. And that'll go to a runoff on December the 19th, in which there's every possibility that Gabriel Boric will win. So much depends on whether the progressive left-wing social democrat forces can actually agree to support Boric in the second round. We won't know until it happens. Let's see.
We'll find out. Okay, and we'll come back next week and take a look at how that all turned out, and then we can start kicking around Honduras, because there's plenty to talk about there, too. Stephen,
there's a lot to talk about on Honduras.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Thank you so much for your time and your expertise and for talking with us. We'll see you again next week.
Okay, thanks a million, Don. Look forward to it.
Thanks.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.